All right, my name is Glenn Siloway. I'm the president of the Historical Society of Morro Bay. Yay, thank you. Thank you. Welcome. We're really happy to have you all here. We have had fun getting ready. I think it's been mostly fun. I know it's been a lot of work, and we've got some great people here who've been helping us. You're going to get to see a good show. I have a few basic things to go over before we get started. First, I'd like to thank the Calvary Lutheran Church for letting us use their fellowship hall. They've been very generous with us. Thank you. Yeah. We've been here, I think, about a year and a half now, and have done a meeting like this about every quarter. So if you don't already get emails from the Historical Society, you can leave your name over here at a sign-up. Name, actually, what I'm going to do and make it easy on you. Now, if you're already on our list, obviously you don't have to sign again, but we do want to stay in touch with you. You're not obligated to join the society by being on our email list, but it's an option that you might want to consider. The support helps us, and we do keep busy doing different things. Our biggest project going on right now is Franklin Riley Park. Franklin Riley Park is right over there, near here, on Morro and Olive over Tidelands. That's almost ready to be set up. We're going to have interpretive panels there. We're doing some plantings. There's a new path, and it's going to be open to the public as always. So take a look, and that's the kind of place where we're going to be in action. Most of what we do is education, and we try to make it fun. So this is our fourth in a series of dramatizations. The first one is Introduction to Franklin Riley, who was one of our founders. Then there was the Case of the Headless Corpse, which was a true story based on some information we liked. We did Gladys Walton here with the help of some of our people who are here again today. And today you're going to hear the story of Prohibition, temperance leading up to Prohibition in Morro Bay and San Luis Obispo County. It's a story that's ongoing, and I'm interested if you see the cultural conflicts that happened in it as we go forward. There's a little bit of a quick story in print up here. You see some cartoons, the editorial cartoons. It's kind of the story of the path to Prohibition in a very short step, so you can take a look at that if you get a chance. So, let's see. All right, we're just about there then. Today we're going to be doing a brief window into the life of Prohibition on the Central Coast and reports. It's based on factual reports of from the people directly or in media of the time. We try to do all of these dramatizations based on the facts as best as we can determine them. So it's history in a little bit more fun form. So now I would like to turn this program over to our historian, Nancy Castle.
Good afternoon, friends, neighbors, ladies and gentlemen. I am the historian, and we are here today to tell the story of what happened right here in San Luis Obispo County during the lengthy, tumultuous push for Prohibition and the period from 1920 to 1933 when the sale of liquor was outlawed in the United States. Humans have had a love-hate relationship with liquor throughout recorded history. The ancients began regulating liquor traffic as far back as 23 centuries before the birth of Christ. In 2250 BC, because public drunkenness was getting so bad, King Hammurabi put into his code of Babylonian law provisions for a fair price for wine. The law also provided that a tavern keeper who permitted disorder was sentenced to death. Fast forward to the 1860s and 1870s in the United States. there were people in the country who supported and benefited from the sale of liquor, not to mention all the people who enjoyed drinking it. Alternatively, there were those who perceived it as an evil that must be stopped by law. The entire country became divided between wet states that permitted liquor sales and dry states that did not. Although California was officially a wet state in 1978, a third political party was formed in California, the Prohibition Party, which was supported by the temperance men and women and the Anti-Saloon League. The Prohibition Party continued to grow and send delegates to the state convention. Then, in San Luis Obispo County in 1898, Templeton voted to establish a sanitation district, a clever euphemism for prohibition, which outlawed the sale of liquor. This was the first law of its kind in San Luis Obispo County. So let's begin by delving into the history of the temperance movement here on the Central Coast. I want to introduce Mrs. J.M. Rutan, who in March of 1901 was elected president of the Women's Christian Temperance Union here in Morro Bay.
Thank you. Thank you. It is a pleasure to be with you here today in the Morro Schoolhouse. First, I want to tell you about the wonderful meeting we had here in the schoolhouse on Sunday. Mrs. King, the state organizer of the Women's Christian Temperance Coalition Union, gave a talk that inspired us all. She is an able speaker and handles her subject well. Quite a number signed the pledge and have been wearing their white ribbons since. She will hold a medal contest at the Methodist Church next Wednesday. All of the friends of our boys and girls are welcome and invited to be present. The admission is 10 cents. I want you all to join with me today. We have prayed for the annihilation of the liquor traffic. And today, we feel that our prayers and the hard work that we have done have not been for naught. God has given us courage and wisdom to go on. Through education, we shall know and heed the voice of truth. And the truth shall make us free. Oh, yes. Oh, here. Today will join me and take the pledge. Oh, yes.
I hereby solemnly promise, God helping me, to abstain from all distilled, fermented, and malt liquors, including wine, beer, and cider, and to employ all proper means to discourage the use of and traffic in the same.
Very good, dear. And here is your white ribbon.
Would you like my signature on this beautiful card?
Sign the card, dear.
Thank you.
Yes, and wear your ribbon with honor.
I will.
And I hope we will see you at the meeting tomorrow.
Thank you, I'll be there.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, is there anyone else here today who wishes to take the pledge?
marriage. Oh, dear! We do have a volunteer over here. Darling, here is a pledge card for you. Please sign it at your leisure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Rutan.
It has been a pleasure to be with you here today.
Thank you, Mrs. Rutan. Now I would like to introduce Mr. J.M. Glass, who came all the way from Pasadena to join us. He has been here in San Luis Obispo before on May 31st, 1911, appearing at the Baptist Church. He spoke for nearly 2 hours, but he will repeat only a few of his comments here today. In its story about his speech, the San Luis Obispo Daily Telegram said that Mr. Glass proved to have the three prerequisites of a successful orator: force, humor, and a thorough knowledge of his subject. The magnetic fire of his eloquence held captive the most wandering attention. Mr. Glass.
Thank you, Ms. Historian. I am very happy to be here today in front of such a large audience. That so many people came to hear me is such an encouraging sign, for only thinking people support prohibition. Let me begin by saying that the saloon is the father of anarchy, the mother of harlotry, the handmaiden of gambling and vice, and the greatest political bandit of the age. And it has this great commonwealth by the throat right now. The curse of generations yet unborn. It is the progenitor and patron of vice, crime, pauperism, and immorality. If the women of today had the same habits as the men, we might as well go back at once to Darwin's monkey, or Spencer's jellyfish, or Huxley's tadpole. If the liquor traffic isn't the devil, there is no devil. Before the Civil War, it was said that the abolitionists were right morally, but wrong constitutionally. Well, thank God, we prohibitionists are right morally and constitutionally. Right. The saloon in the United States gets 100,000 victims a year, 300 in one day, 12 in every hour, and one in every 5 minutes. It gets one boy in every 5 families, and one girl in every 10 families. I could go on and on with statistics that show that the dry states have fewer criminals than the wet ones. Come up here so you can talk in the microphone.
Now, I have been told that with the money made from the sale of liquor here in town, that it adds significantly to the prosperity of the community. It pays for many valuable things, education included. It furthers the welfare of the common people. Is this true? Now, I'm going to sit down and wait for your response.
You take the revenue derived from the saloon license and spend it teaching one half of the people to avoid patronizing the place where the other half goes to supply the revenue. The revenue bugaboo raised by the saloon men makes no sense. The tax rates for dry towns are much lower than the tax rates for wet ones, but thank you for your question. Let me conclude, ladies and gentlemen, by saying that the ballot has been denied women largely because of their opposition to the saloon and other evils. The saloons, gamblers, prostitutes, and other corrupt influences elements were opposed to the ballot for women because they know that the women's vote could mean a cleanup of the government.
Yay. Yeah.
Now, I want you all to stand up for prohibition. Stand up. Stand up for women's suffrage. And stand up. Thank you. Stand up for Christian socialism. The government each for all and all for each in the spirit of neighborly love and the golden rule to give women the ballot with which to abolish the saloon. Thank you all for coming, and we will now sing one of our favorite hymns, Onward Christian Soldiers.
Thank you, brother.
Onward Christian soldiers, marching as to war. With the cross of Jesus going on before.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Glass. As we know, the prohibitionists were successful in getting the U.S. Congress to pass a constitutional amendment outlawing all intoxicating liquors. On January 16, 1920, the 18th Amendment, the National Prohibition Enforcement Act, became law. As Mr. Glass pointed out, all the organizing that was accomplished by the Women's Christian Temperance Union and the Anti-Saloon League to outlaw the sale of liquor was closely coordinated with the movement to secure women's right to vote. This provided an ideal opportunity for women's voices to be heard and for them to have a direct influence on government policy. Enforcement of the National Prohibition Enforcement Act was impossible. And seasoned drinkers ignored it in the same way that speed limits are ignored today. The inability to enforce prohibition was characterized by bootlegging, gangsters, and speakeasy. Despite prohibition, liquor was still a common commodity on the West Coast. Illegal liquor came down from Vancouver, Canada, and up from Mexico in Baja, California. In Canada and Mexico, liquor was a legal commodity. Suppliers in both countries were eager to profit from a United States under prohibition. By the early 1920s, bootlegging became an important part of the economy of the Central Coast. Next, I want to introduce two gentlemen who say they were not directly involved in rum running, as illegal transportation and sale of liquor was often called, but they were aware of much of what was happening and how prohibition worked here on the Estero Bay. Tommy Thomas and Miles Castle. Tommy and Miles roomed together during this period. They were both British and good friends. Their meeting in 1938, after the end of Prohibition, to reminisce. And their meeting at Happy Jack's Bar, which opened in Morro Bay during Prohibition.
Hello, fellas. It's so good to see you again. It's been a while. So, hey, what can I get ya?
Well, Miles, what can you have? I'm buying.
Just my usual. Shot of Canadian whiskey, if you please, Tommy. And you?
The same. I'll have the same.
Good to see you. You know, it's been a long time since we've done this.
Here you go, fellas.
Well, thank you so much.
Whoa.
Hey, do you remember how it started? You know, after that silly prohibition law passed? Man, you know, Miles, that law never really stopped people from drinking. I remember how up in San Simeon Ranch, that Randolph Hearst guy, he kept serving booze to all his high and mighty. And down in Oceano Dunes, that Hollywood, they filmed Lawrence of Arabia. And my friend, who was an extra, Well, he said those movie stars, they drank a lot of whiskey during that movie.
I think we all knew that many folks continued to drink. Making it illegal didn't stop them. It just made it a lot harder to find places to get it.
Well, do you remember my friend, Slim Forsland? You know, we both got involved. And he went down to Los Angeles, and we were looking at a boat to buy for a contract that we had with Standard Oil. And we had this contract to help tie up the tankers up in Sterile Bay, but we needed a boat. Well, we had just registered at a hotel in L.A., and we went to our room with a key, and when we walked in, there were two men in our room. What the? Well, they said they would donate a boat if they could use it on occasion. Now, apparently, they had overheard us talking. And so now we acquired that tugboat, which we now call the Nova Roma. But that boat led a double life. One, during the day, it worked for Standard Oil. Well, and you can imagine, at night. Well, we were told by that pair from Los Angeles to leave it anchored off of Cayucas, but leave the tanks full and make sure that those keys are left in it.
Yeah.
And we did. Well, we didn't ask any questions. But we knew it was going to be used for, well, bootlegging. Slim said to me, "Why shouldn't the rest of us benefit from breaking a bad law? You think about it, it was an easy to organize bootlegging here on the Central Coast because there was no Coast Guard. Federal law enforcement was nearly non-existent, and between San Francisco and Los Angeles, we just didn't find any. The most popular locations to offload liquor were Spooner's Cove, Pismo Beach, Avila, and of course, Morro Bay."
Oh, yes. We all knew what happened at night. The Canadian ships would dock outside the 3-mile limit, send signals to shore, and someone would take your boat out to meet them.
Mm-hmm.
They'd unload the cases of alcohol and bring them ashore where canvas-covered trucks were waiting. The trucks could easily be spotted in daylight by revenuers, those local prohibition officers appointed by the U.S. Treasury Department to help enforce federal and local law. I always call them the pro-highs. Well, they had to find local farmers who would hide the trucks during daylight until the next evening when they drove their cargo down to Los Angeles. We all knew that your boat wasn't the only one used that way. Of course, everyone involved in the operation was paid a bit of money or got to keep some of the contraband, sometimes both. And that includes the farmers who helped hide those trucks during the day. Oh, Tommy, do you remember the Frooms? Hard-working dairy family living just outside San Luis Obispo at the intersection of the country road and the state highway. Well, turns out that location gave them a grandstand seat for the parade of bootleggers from Spooner's Cove, Morro Bay, and points north. During winter, that road becomes a muddy quagmire. And often, when Mr. Froome and one or two of his boys got up early in the morning around 4 a.m. to milk the cows, they would hear the dogs barking loudly. And when they'd go to investigate, they'd find a truck stuck in the mud. The maroon drivers would give them $10 to help get the truck unstuck. So the Froome boys would harness a team, get the chains, and go down the road to pull the truck out. Oh, God. Some mornings, they'd find two trucks stuck. The Froomes made enough money in the towing business to buy an old Studebaker car. One of the boys told me the trucks hauled liquor from Canada. Coming in boats or ships in 5-gallon cans, you know. A single shipment could be worth $50,000.
Oh, my good. That's a lot of money. Miles, do you remember the time that Slim almost got caught? Well, it was a foggy night, and Slim was bringing the boat back, and he heard another boat. Oh, and it was sure it was the government men. They kept cutting their engines, and Slim cut his. With no breakwaters, no dredged channel, the north channel was completely closed, the foghorns non-existent, the sea deep. Well, Slim took a dislike to these conditions. Slim ran the boat aground, went over the side, waded ashore on the sand spit, and crossed the bay on foot to get help from a buddy. Well, that tug stood in full view all day. And later, it was unloaded when the tide came in and there was 14 feet of water.
But yours wasn't the only boat put to that use, was it, Tommy?
Nope. Sometimes those rum runners use the Standard Oil tug, the Rainier, to run out to the supply. Yeah. Of course, officially, Standard Oil said they had no knowledge of the Rainier's double life, nor that of the Nova Roma.
Unfortunately, though, not everyone got away with it. Think about the Spooners. I'm not sure we'll ever know the whole truth about what happened to them. Here's a wealthy family with an 800-acre farm. And the three Spooner boys get caught smuggling whiskey offloaded at the ranch in Spooner's Cove.
Oh. Well, you know, I heard that they were more or less blackmailed by a parcel of underworld characters. And I don't know if they refused to cooperate with the bootleggers or if they let them use the cove and the ranch for trafficking liquor. Well, the story is the bribery money was left in the barn for the brothers, after each of those capers, until the day that the rum runners saw the handwriting on the wall. Then they turned coat and joined the IRS. So I heard. Then they framed two of the three brothers by means of a conversation reported by the bootleggers themselves. I believe that Alden Spooner, grandson of Quincy, who served 2 years in prison and paid a hefty $2,500 fine, made a deal with those federal authorities so that his younger brother Carson could avoid conviction. Anyways, the judge found Carson not guilty.
And Bill Froome told me about a friend of his who had a tucked away dairy farm in Morro Bay.
Mm-hmm.
A local saloon owner persuaded him to start distilling, reasoning that nobody would discover his little brewery. One day, the Morro Bay farmer filled 3 milk cans with his grog and set out to deliver them to the saloon owner. But the dairy farmer sampled it first to calm his nerves, which led to some erratic driving. He backed up and drove to the curb in front of the saloon, headed the wrong way.
Naturally.
Then he ran when the police showed up, but they caught him and turned him over to the federal agents. Sentenced to 2 years in jail. But got lucky when he was granted a lenient punishment of probation because he had a large family to support.
Yeah, but you know, it was really easy for the rest of us to avoid detection. Well, the way we saw it, we were outstanding citizens. And the 18th Amendment was just so foolish. You can't stop a man from doing what he naturally wants to do. You've got to admit, Miles, that we had lots of fun outsmarting those revenueers. I don't know if you remember what happened one night along the Estero Bay, just north of Morro Bay. It happened during the early 1920s. Flashing lights were seen far out at sea. The freighters from Canada were waiting to unload the crates of booze. But the revenuers had also seen those lights. They were watching with binoculars from the hillside roads above the coastline. A couple of the local farmers spotted these federal men, and they got on the party line phones that connected the dairies and hatched a brilliant plan. Dozens of farmers drove their Model Ts and Model As and trucks to the beaches, and a few fishing boats then arrived. Ah, and a full hour was taken uploading these heavy, heavy crates and transferring them to the waiting vehicles. Well, the cars and trucks drove off in the direction of the main highway. The revenuers followed them. Well, after about 20 minutes had passed, a group of boats landed on the shore. The familiar canvas-covered trucks pulled up along the edge of the beaches. They quickly took on their payload and drove off to the shelter of the friendly dairy barns. By that time, the embarrassed revenuers were stopping innocent farmers with crates of rocks from Old Creek in their car trunks and truck beds. And some of those farmers explained that these were added for traction on the sandy beaches. They claimed to have been at a friendly clam bake.
Yes, Tommy, I do recall when that happened. That was a good one. You know, you almost got me in trouble with your connection to Slim Forsland and the Nova.
No.
You were rooming with me and some of those shady characters who gave you that boat sometimes stopped by, which may be the reason the pro heist thought I was also involved in that business. One time, I was followed from work at the tank farm all the way home. But I knew who those pro highs were. So I invited a young lady to go for a ride.
Oh.
And drove slowly, meandering through San Luis Obispo, over the Cuesta Grade, and back to Atascadero and home. On the way, we stopped and took our own sweet time, walking through barns. They followed us the whole way. That day I sure succeeded in wasting a lot of those pro highs time.
Hey, fellas, I couldn't help but overhear some of what you were talking about. I used to work at a speakeasy.
No.
And when we couldn't get the good stuff from Canada, we had to buy from local moonshiners. But the quality of that moonshine liquor was so bad that we had to mix it with something just to make it drinkable. That's why we have mixed drinks today.
Well, I'll...
And the booze served at the speakeasy was expensive. Mm. Why? The costs were high. The proprietors were always afraid of raids, gangster holdups, and a closure by authorities.
Mm-hmm.
The law could not provide them with protection. They were dependent upon corrupt policemen who extorted much of the profits.
Mm-hmm.
It was tough times.
Mm.
Hey, Phyllis, you want another one?
Oh, no, I better be off. Well, Tommy, this sure has been fun remembering the good old days. Thanks for the drink, old friend.
You're sure welcome, Miles. It's been a pleasure. Oh, he skipped out on me. I'll pay for it.
Thank you both for those stories. It sounds like an exciting time around here during the 1920s. Throughout the Prohibition era, there were cries for repeal across the nation. The law was simply unenforceable.
On February 16, 1933, after 14 years, the U.S. Senate voted to submit the 21st Amendment, which provided for the repeal of the 18th Amendment and the end of national prohibition. The days of speakeasies were over and saloons restored, except after prohibition, they were typically called taverns, bars, cafes, or clubs. Incidentally, the term speakeasy was first used to describe an unlicensed saloon. The expression came from Ireland, where such saloons were called speak softly shops. Speakeasies were located in basements, back rooms, and upstairs apartments. Often they had special fronts to make them look like something else, like drugstores, coffee houses, soda fountains, barber shops, and even a funeral parlor occasionally. I want to thank you all for being here today, and this is another demonstration of history can be fun. Yeah.
Thanks for that trip into the past. I hope you enjoyed it. Complicated world back then, and it is today. I'm going to introduce the cast, but I want you to know that when I finish, I'm going to ask you for your stories of Prohibition, because I bet there's some family lore among you, and we'd like to hear those stories. So our historian, Nancy Castle, is our living treasure. That's an official title, by the way. And she's also the daughter of Miles and the brother of Roger Castle, who is on our board, and a longtime active member in Morro Bay. Mr. J.M. Rutan, oh, I'm sorry, Mrs. J.M. Rutan, I've got to be able to read. Janice Lamont, who always dreamed of being an actor, now in retirement, she performs improv with the Central Coast Comedy Theater, and was recently seen in By the Sea Productions play, The Importance of Being Earnest. Thank you, Janice. Agnes Cole was played by our own Donna Stoll, who is a member of our board. Yes, our secretary of our board. Thank you, Donna. Mr. J.M. Glass was played by Don Gady. Don? Don is a mostly retired physician who regularly volunteers at the Norm Medical Clinic. He has also appeared in plays at By the Seas production and elsewhere. The intrepid questioner from the audience is, stand up, Joe. This is Joe Ingrafia. He's also Joe is also a member of our board. And Miles Castle was played by Laurel Barnett Kelty, and say. So Laurel has also appeared in By the Sea production plays, most recently seen as Reverend Chasuble in The Importance of Being Earnest, where she first took on the challenge of transcending gender. Tommy Thomas was played by Chuck Stoll. Probably known well to all of you as the president of the Lions Club and a frequent helper at the Monday night dinner and lots of other great things. Chuck's really great to have you here. His first trip with us was as a member of the cast of the Case of the Headless Corpse. Our barmaid was Victoria Schmidt. Yes. So Victoria has been a longtime volunteer. She was on the board of the Slow Symphony for many years and is a Historical Society member. Our director, you all know Janice Peters. Janice, yes. Janice is a former council member, a former mayor, the founder of By the Sea Productions, and a great help to this society in many ways. And finally, I'd like to introduce you to the script author, Marlis McPherson. Some of you may know her also. Marlis has been active in lots of things, lots of places, and lots of ways. She was the city council member 2016 to 2020. Glad that's over. And she's going to explain where the information that is behind this, the factual stuff that supported this play, comes from.
Thank you, Glenn. Yeah, as Glenn mentioned earlier, it's really important when you do a dramatic historical presentation that you are speaking true things. And so all of the information that was contained in the script is accurate, and a lot of verbatim quotes were used where appropriate. So here are the sources. First, the History Center of San Luis Obispo, which if you just read the paper, has lost its county funding, so is in dire straits at the moment. They have an extensive collection of newspaper articles about temperance. The Daily Telegram, one of two local papers in San Luis Obispo at the time, published articles that include they included the entire speech that Mr. Glass made. It took three editions of the paper to write the whole speech, but it was he exactly quoted what Mr. Glass said, as well as Mrs. Rattan. She also, her comments were not all from her, but they were from women temperance presidents. During 2003 and 2004, the Tribune, the other San Luis Obispo paper, published a series of articles written by historian Dan Krieger. And they included extensive interviews with Bill Froome, who was one of the young boys who was pulling trucks out of the mud. The book Moral Bay's Yesterdays by Dorothy Gates and Jane Bailey contains a section about rum running, and that is based in part on interviews with Miles Castle. And of course, Roger and Nancy provided stories told by their father, so that's where that came from. The Spooner's Ranch House, operated by the Morro Bay Museum of Natural History, located in Montana de Oro, contains information about the Spooners. And then we had some other incidental sources, including the Cal Poly Historical Society. And just this morning, I was reading a mystery story that it was a throwaway mystery, but it was it involved a historian. And this was a line that kind of struck me, and so I just want to share it with you as a way to conclude. History matters. You have to make history real for it to matter to the ones who come afterward. And since I was coming to this today, I just thought, it's perfect. So we would like to hear stories from all of you about things that happened that you know happened from probably your parents or grandparents or somebody during Prohibition. And Joe, I know you know have one, so please. And anybody who has one.
We have a mic if you want to stand.
Well, it's really only a shred of the story because...
It might not be on, John.
Can you hear me? It's really only the shred of a story because every time my grandfather would start to tell it, usually my grandmother, my Sicilian grandmother, would interrupt and cut the story short because she didn't think it was appropriate for grandchildren to hear. But apparently my grandfather and his brother decided to go into the bootlegging business, and they managed to lease a farm on the outskirts of Battle Creek, Michigan. Unfortunately, what they didn't know was that the neighboring farm was owned by the local sheriff of the county. But even more importantly, they didn't know that the local sheriff was the major bootlegger in the county. And their enterprise did not last very long.
Anybody else have a story to tell?
Yeah, I have a story. Thank you. When I was in high school, I had a friend whose mother was a French Basque. And back during Prohibition, she and her brother were very embarrassed because they couldn't take baths for weeks at a time. Their father was making wine in the bathroom.
Yeah. Any more stories out there?
Oh, come on. Yeah, nobody's going to come in. Yeah, there we are.
Well, this goes way back, and I don't...
It's on.
Oh, okay. Is it on?
Yeah.
Okay. My grandfather, our family was from originally from Upper Peninsula in Michigan, a little town called Escanaba. And Escanaba is just right on that lake, just close enough to the Canadian border that they took advantage of this. He never really spoke too much about it. In fact, he never did, actually, because he had a beautiful sailboat, and that sailboat would frequently go over to the Canadian border, and several of his fellow friends in their sailboats. And I always wondered how he had such a nice sailboat. But my father then explained to me that, you know, there was a business back then, and they felt the same way as many people did. It was a crazy, silly law, and they just took advantage of it. And so I guess I should be very thankful, at least from that part, because I got to sail on that boat a few times. It was very nice.
This is not really about prohibition, but I grew up in Arkansas, and we have counties that are dry and counties that are wet to this day, and cities that are dry are wet inside of dry counties, so it's an unusual situation. We lived in a dry county. The Arkansas River ran by, and Fort Smith on the other side of the river was wet. And I didn't know this at the time, but it was in a dry county, but we always thought Sebastian County was wet, but it was just Fort Smith that was wet. The favorite expression of the males in our family back there when I was a boy was that we're going across the river, and we all knew what that meant. And as soon as you go down the highway, the first two things you see as you cross the bridge, there's a liquor store as you come out and a liquor store as you go in. So... And there was one guy in our county who sold illegal whiskey, and he ran it through a sausage place. It was called Whole Hog or None. So if you're going to go buy sausage from Whole Hog or None, there's a very good chance you're going to get some liquor out of it.
So I helped with some of the research regarding the topic and learned that prior to prohibition, the per person consumption of alcohol was really quite high. And so prohibition may not have succeeded the way people thought it might, but today's level is one third to one half of what it was prior to prohibition. So there's less alcohol consumed now, and probably as a result of prohibition, there's no longer the 11 o'clock bell being run for the liquor break. It's not part of Army rations anymore. And so it had some success. Also, my grandmother worked on a farm in North Dakota during prohibition and had harvest workers come, and they would go into town and buy alcohol. But they'd get sick. And so she started making beer right on the farm. So they might get drunk, but they could still work the next day.
Anything else?
I've got a couple.
There you go. Ooh. I knew there'd be more.
Here we go. So my dad worked during prohibition at the tank farm, which was up on the bluff going towards Cayucas. And the pier, the Standard Oil pier, was right out where Dog Beach is right now. And so that's where the two tankers would, or the two tugs would tie up. Thank you. So he was real aware of what was going on all the time and rooming with Tommy. And, you know, the way he told his stories, you could never really tell if he was involved or not. One story where he did get pretty directly involved, was the man who owned the lot next to the Airport Cafe. And maybe some of you know that there's a little wooden building is still there just down from Todd's garage. And that was the cafe for the airport, which was the strip that became the freeway. And so Dad was hired by somebody, whoever owned the lot next to the Airport Cafe, to go mow it. And he goes up there and he unloads his mower and he's getting ready. And the cafe owner comes running out going, "Miles, Miles, don't. All my bottles are hidden out in those weeds." So Dad loads the mower back on his truck, goes away, and that evening comes back and he helps the tavern owner move all the bottles, and then he comes the next day and actually cuts all of the grass. So let's see, what else can I remember? I remember one story he liked telling was he came home to Tommy and wherever they were rooming. And for some reason, I think it's the little cottages that are still there right on the bluff. There's a building, they're small buildings, and they're probably Airbnbs at this point. But he comes home and the neighborhood is filled with big black vehicles. And he goes, "Oh, this doesn't look real good." So he goes in and sure enough, there's all of these men in suits and the hats, I mean, classic. And Dad goes, "You know, I don't think it's a really good idea that we have all these trucks, vehicles parked out here." And one of the guys snaps his finger and all these men get up and they go out and they move the cars all over town so it spread out. So, and then let's see, one more. The fabulous gentleman, Bill Roy, was the caretaker of the golf course, manager of the golf course. And he goes down one morning and whichever tee it is right across from Windy Cove is all torn up with all of these tire tracks in it. And he calls my dad going, "We got to do something. We got to fix this," because Dad was kind of a handyman around town. So what had happened is that they'd picked Windy Cove to bring the liquor in, and then all the little trucks that they loaded into drove around on this wonderful flat surface and tore up the green. So, you know, if you're out there playing, think of having a tipple for everybody.
Yay. Any more? Is that it? Can't remember. I got one more I want to tell you. It comes from Last Call, the book about Prohibition and the times leading up to it. But one of the stories is about Johnny Appleseed. You remember him? So Johnny Appleseed wandered around the Midwest with apple seeds in his pocket, and the myth is that he started all these orchards. And you wonder, I always wondered, why would this guy do this? What prompted him to want to go out and plant olive trees or apple trees? It turns out that cider was so important in the diet in those days that apples were very important. Apples turned into hard cider, which kept people kind of getting along. They would start in the morning and they would drink in the middle of the day and they'd drink at night. One guy said they hear a bell to ring to get up and start drinking, and they hear a bell to ring to stop drinking at the end of the day, and they go to sleep. There was a place in, I think it was in Ohio, where if you had a farm, to get a title to that land, you actually had to agree to plant an orchard because the liquor was so important to people. So we started our life as a country deeply in need of help. So I appreciate you being here. If you have any more stories, send them to us. We'll be putting some of this online when we can get to it. If you have the sign up for your email, hang on to it. Sign up if you can. Maybe it's over on this door, on this table. Our board member, Alice Kolb, has produced a feast. There's a lot of food here. We expect you to clean that table off before you leave. I don't know if we have anything for them to take it in, but you have pockets, right? So in about 3 months, we'll be doing another program. If you're on our email, you'll hear about it. We enjoy having you here. We enjoy doing this. Doing this kind of history is a fun thing for all of us. I hope you enjoyed it. And we'll be doing it again, and see you soon. Thank you. Yeah, let's hear it for AGP.